Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, Columbia Law School professor Nathaniel Persily looks at the history of redistricting and gerrymandering in the United States. Professor Persily discusses the origin of the term gerrymandering in the early 1800s and the use of redistricting by political parties and incumbents to protect and advance their interests. He also talks about more racially charged redistricting fights, such as the 1960 Gomillion v. Lightfoot Supreme Court case, in which the court found that a district had been created to disenfranchise black voters. That case helped lead to the 1965 Voting Rights Act, outlawing discriminatory voting practices. Columbia Law School is located in New York City. This is a little over an hour.
Welcome to everyone at home as well. We're going to continue our discussion of redistricting law. Last time we dealt with one person, one vote and the malapportionment cases, and we'll review those. And we'll also talk about sort of historical examples of gerrymandering. The word gerrymander comes from Elbridge Gerry, the anti-federalist governor of Massachusetts, who in 1812 passed a redistricting plan which looked like a salamander. And it's because of that districting plan, and in particular, one of the districts in it, specifically this one right here, that we then had the term gerrymander coined. Let's see. So if you look, this is a picture of Massachusetts, and that was the district right here, which Elbridge Gerry drew. Despite the fact that the Federalists won more votes in the 1812 election, about 1,000 more votes or so, the Democratic Republicans won more seats in the state Senate. It's because of a district like that. When one of the journalists at the time saw this district, he said, well, that's, someone next to him said, that's a salamander. And he said, no, that's a gerrymander. And so these are the different towns that were put together in order to craft the malapportioned and unrepresentative redistricting plan at the time. As I said, it was both a partisan gerrymander where the anti-federalists, the Democratic Republicans, were trying to gain an advantage, and it was also malapportioned. So each of these districts, each one of them had, they were multi-member districts, where there were three state senators for that district, which was the gerrymander. But as you can see, because of the different numbers of people who were in each of the district, the different numbers of representatives, they were able to draw the lines in such a way as to ensure that the party in power was able to stay in power. Now, the history of gerrymandering in this country, if we had to sort of break down the themes that we're going to be dealing with in this course and then this section, we look particularly at partisan gerrymanders, we look at racial gerrymanders, and we look at incumbent protecting gerrymanders. In the early days, basically, as you know, before the one person, one vote cases, the court almost never got involved in the law of gerrymandering and the law of redistricting. The one example that precedes the one person, one vote cases occurs with the Tuskegee gerrymander of 1957 and the case of Gomillion versus Lightfoot. The boundaries of Tuskegee were redrawn previous to the redistricting plan. The boundaries of Tuskegee looked like that square that you can see here. They were then redrawn to excise basically all but 9 African Americans from the entire city in a 28-sided uncouth figure. And this is from the Supreme Court's document. In doing so, the court didn't, in striking down the Tuskegee gerrymander, the Supreme Court didn't declare a fundamental right to vote in the Equal Protection Clause, which we've discussed when we talked about Harper versus Virginia Board of Elections. They didn't even give a robust interpretation of even the 15th Amendment, except to say that in a districting plan like this, where you are basically, through the line drawing process, taking people out because of their race, right? That violates the 15th Amendment because it's as if you were disenfranchising African Americans. Because at time one, African Americans had the right to vote in the city of Tuskegee, right? And at time two, they've been excised from it. So it's just as if you had passed a law that said African Americans can't vote in Tuskegee. Right? But except for the Gamillion versus Lightfoot case, right? For the most part, the court took the instructions that we talked about last time from Justice Frankfurter in Colgrove versus Green, that redistricting and reapportionment was a political thicket, that the court shouldn't be involved, that there were extreme dangers from getting involved, that there was it would cast into doubt the impartiality of the judiciary, that this was not an area where there were manageable judicial standards where they could intervene in order to regulate the political process. Because as we discussed, it's hard to think of an area where the different branches of government would be so much put into conflict, like in the context of gerrymandering. So that in fact, when courts go in and review redistricting plans, they are, in a sense, deciding sometimes which party is going to be in power, which legislators are going to be kicked out of office, which communities are going to be represented. And so given the general restraint prior to the Warren Court era, the court never really got involved in redistricting cases. Now, all that changed, as we discussed, with the one person, one vote cases, and we'll review them just a bit. But before we get there, I just want to also show you other ways that you can dilute and gerrymander. So we saw in the Massachusetts situation that through malapportionment and through the grouping of political adversaries, you can overrepresent or underrepresent different groups. Here is another example where through the cracking of a particular community, you can underrepresent them. This was a proposed redistricting plan in Mississippi in the 1960s, where the African-American population is all along the Delta here. And so they drew the congressional districts going east-west in order to make sure that each one of the districts was minority black, right? If you wanted to, if you drew the districts north-south instead of east-west, you could ensure that a majority African-American district could have been drawn. But drawing them east-west is a way of ensuring that the African-American community is diluted and that their vote is, they're less likely to elect their candidates of choice. And so these historical examples describe different strategies that line drawers can use in order to overrepresent the communities they want, underrepresent others. And so I want to just pause for a second to talk about the different strategies with gerrymandering. So we've been hinting at the idea of vote dilution. And as I said in the last class, the notion of a diluted vote assumes that there's something like an undiluted vote, right? That to make an argument about how a community is improperly or underrepresented, you have to have some kind of baseline as to what you think proper representation would look like. The strategic decisions that line drawers make can be grouped into a few examples. So as I was showing you before, you can diminish the influence of your political opponents in certain ways. You can pack them into too few districts, right? You can crack them by spreading them out among too many. And then you can also stack them. If you remember what Elbridge Gerry did, he drew the districts in such a way so that there were multi-member districts. And so, for example, if you have a state that's 30% African American, and you don't elect by districts at all, but you have the entire state electing four or five congressmen, then you can ensure that a geographically concentrated minority will not be able to elect its candidate of choice. You can see how this works. Let's take Atlanta. This is a districting plan that I was involved in 10 years ago. So the dark green areas are the heavily African American areas, really some sort of 90% African American here. If you draw the districts inside Atlanta, right, you'll end up drawing districts that are over 90% African American. Now, if you join them with the largely white suburbs, right, then they end up being about 30% African American. And if there's racially polarized voting, right, if African Americans and whites are voting for different candidates, you can dilute the black vote by taking either strategy, right? And so there is a kind of Goldilocks principle of redistricting, right? Not too hot, not too cold, but to get it just right, assuming that what you're trying to do is establish accurate representation. So those are the strategies of gerrymandering. We characterize gerrymanders into one of several categories. A partisan gerrymander typically is drawn by over-concentrating your opponents into as few districts as possible and under-concentrating your supporters, right? So take, for example, the Republican gerrymander of Pennsylvania that we talk about in Veith versus Jubilee. In that case, several of the districts in inner city Philadelphia were heavily Democratic. But as you tried to, on the periphery, crack those supporters, you tried to create about 55%, 60% Republican districts, right? So you have efficient districts for your friends and inefficient districts for your adversaries, right? That's typically the way a partisan gerrymander works. If you do go in that direction, of course, there are risks, right? Because if there's a small shift in voter preferences, which is what happened in Pennsylvania, then your party can lose a whole good number of seats. A bipartisan gerrymander is typically done where you make seats that are safe for both parties. So the Republicans get safe seats, the Democrats get safe seats. If the state is half Democrat, half Republican, half the seats will be heavily Democrat, half the seats will be heavily Republican. Often that also involves the strategic placement of incumbents, so you make sure the incumbents are protected. And an incumbent protecting gerrymander is not exactly the same thing as a bipartisan gerrymander. Sometimes incumbents don't want to be in the safest districts possible from their party standpoint, but they want to be in the most familiar districts possible, ones that have elected them before and ones that will continue to elect them in the future. Okay. Now, given the commentary about redistricting and the nausea it seems to instill among so many in the media, there are all kinds of proposals, good government proposals, that are out there. And so often the question is, well, why don't we do the right thing, right? And what is the right thing? And if you look at different state laws, they have different requirements. Some of them require that you have compact districts. In fact, many of them do, based on political subdivision lines like counties or cities or something like that. Others require that you respect communities of interest, a slippery concept that could mean everything from religious communities to union communities to coastal communities. However, you can define any community by its interests. Arizona has an interesting requirement that says you have to promote competition. Others try to insulate it from partisanship. Florida, for example, recently passed an initiative that said no district or plan may be passed that favors or disfavors a party or an incumbent in order to avoid partisan bias or promote responsiveness. And then oftentimes there will be a preference that courts will apply in the event they get involved to adopt just a least change plan. And in speaking about court involvement, since this is a law school class, one thing you need to keep in mind in looking at these redistricting cases and looking at the different legal requirements is that in the event that the legislature fails to draw lines or the other redistricting authority fails to draw lines, now the courts are permanent players. And so if you do nothing, when I say you, if you, the legislature, do nothing, then the consequence is that whichever court gets involved, either a state court or federal court, will then be the backup line drawing authority. I talked about my experiences recently drawing the congressional districts for Connecticut. I'll show you some other redistricting plans that I've drawn for Georgia and New York. So the default option, if you do nothing, is to, as a consequence, you have the courts get involved. And so sometimes legislatures will gamble on that. In fact, right now, that's the story here in New York, that the Democrats and Republicans have not gotten together on a redistricting plan. And so a court has been impaneled, and they're having hearings just today at 2 p.m. Okay, so those are the strategies. Just a brief 2 minutes on the inputs into the redistricting process, what those of us who draw lines pay attention to when we're drawing the lines. Some of you are also in my redistricting class where we're actually sitting down and drawing the different maps for each state. The basic building blocks of redistricting plans are census data. Okay, and census data, the census provides you with population data, total population data, and voting age population by race for every level of geography in the United States. So the smallest census unit of geography is a block, then a tract, then a county, then the state, right? And for every level of geography, we have racial data broken down by the total population and voting age population data broken down by race. And not only just by race, the six major racial categories that we have on the census, but every combination, because you're allowed to draw, you're allowed to check off more than one race on the census form. So the six major racial categories are white, African American, Asian, Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander, American Indian or Alaska Native, or some other race. So there's six major categories. You'll notice that Hispanic is not one of those because it's asked of another question where being a Hispanic or Latino is seen as an ethnicity and not a race. But when you combine them all together, you end up with 126 different racial and ethnic combinations for every little level of geography in the census. So in addition to just the population data from the census, we often have other kinds of data. Everything that you can see on Google Maps, you can probably put into a redistricting program, whether it's political subdivision lines like cities and counties, old district lines, topographical features like mountains, rivers, et cetera, highways and railroads. And then if you're one of the insiders, and sometimes the outsiders as well, you'll have political data, such as voter registration data, political election returns, and for example, where incumbents are going to live. One thing you should know is that in trying to assess the partisan bias of a redistricting plan and whether districts are going to perform for one or another party, the voter registration statistics are often not the really reliable data that you want, because particularly in the South, for example, there are a lot of white Democrats, historically, who've been Democrats for 50 years, but whose voting patterns are much different than other Democrats. And so you end up, if you pay attention only to party registration, it's not going to be a good predictor of how people vote. So the better statistics are election returns, looking at how different precincts have been voting in previous elections to get a good estimate of the likely political performance of an area. And so you can define communities by their politics, or you can define them, as I said, by communities of interest, which is to say, you know, looking at how religious they are, what industries are there, who, you know, are there union towns, as well as a host of anecdotal evidence that you will get in redistricting hearings. I think I've told you when I was one of the experts doing the redistricting 10 years ago in New York, we had someone, a little old lady from the Upper West Side of Manhattan, who came in and testified before our hearing, who said, whatever you do, don't put the Upper East Side with the Upper West Side. We're completely different than those people. You know, they'll let anyone build whatever the heck they want over there, but we here, you know, we're a different community. And the idea is, you know, so it's like she was talking about Bosnia, right? I mean, this is, are we so different just across the park? But, you know, you go over there and say, well, it is a little bit different than the Upper West Side, right? And so different communities are going to define themselves differently. Now, let's move just to the legal constraints, which is where we'll spend the remainder of the lecture. The constitutional constraints, which is what we're going to talk about today, we'll leave the Voting Rights Act for the next time. The constitutional constraints, the U.S. constitutional constraints, can be summarized pretty simply. The first is one person, one vote, right? As we've described, that there are different rules for both congressional elections and non-congressional elections, as well as special purpose districts. Second, the prohibition on intentional racial discrimination and dilution, because the redistricting plans are just like any other kind of state action, that when you intentionally discriminate against a racial group, trying to minimize their political influence, that will violate the 14th Amendment. Third, there's another analytically distinct claim coming out of the case Shaw versus Reno, which prohibits the use of the race as the predominant factor in the construction of a district. And then finally, there is what I'll just call an unenforced prohibition on partisan gerrymandering. There's still, you can still litigate these cases. You can bring the claims into court, but the Supreme Court has never found a partisan gerrymandering case that has satisfied its standards. Now, those are the U.S. constitutional constraints. But when dealing with race and redistricting, you have to think about the Voting Rights Act as well. And so while we'll be spending about 2 weeks or more on the Voting Rights Act, let me just give you a glimpse of what the Voting Rights Act requires right now. As a result of Dixiecrat intransigence through the 1960s, Lyndon Johnson and others banded together to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It has two principal provisions, Section 2 and Section 5, as well as other provisions, as we've talked about, which ban literacy tests, et cetera. Section 5 is unique in that it only applies to certain areas of the country, most parts of the South, but it also applies to three boroughs in New York City. It applies to Arizona and Alaska, parts of Texas, or all of Texas, and parts of California. And so it's unique in that it has this geographic feature that it doesn't apply nationwide. It also requires something of states and localities that no other law requires. If you are covered under the Voting Rights Act, whenever you pass a law with respect to voting, you must get preclearance from the Department of Justice or the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Okay? Before that law goes into effect, whether you are moving a polling place or passing a redistricting plan, you have to get permission from the federal government to pass and enforce that law. And the DC District Court or the DOJ will decide whether the law has a discriminatory purpose, any discriminatory purpose, and whether it has a retrogressive effect. Retrogressive is a term of art in voting rights law. It means, does it make minorities worse off? Okay, and in particular, does it diminish the ability of a racial group to elect their preferred candidates of choice? All right. So if it has either a discriminatory purpose or it makes minorities worse off, for example, if you have majority-minority district, majority-minority meaning that minorities comprise a voting majority of a district under the current lines, and then you crack and split up that community in the new lines, the Department of Justice will say that has a retrogressive effect, that it's making that group worse off. Now, as I said, that only applies to certain areas of the country, and it's where there are several cases going through the courts right now challenging its constitutionality yet again. And so it's likely that in the next year or so, the Supreme Court may strike down that particular law as unconstitutional. But there's another part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which is like other pieces of civil rights legislation. It applies across the country. And it's unique as a constraint on redistricting, a federal constraint on redistricting, in that it prevents vote dilution. All right. So the maps that I was showing you before about the African Americans in Atlanta, it's those types of stratagems that the Section 2 is intended to avoid. In areas where there's racially polarized voting, where minorities and whites vote for different candidates, the cracking and packing of minorities would be illegal under that. But in addition to the federal law, the constitutional law plus the Voting Rights Act, there are also state law claims, as I was saying before. Some states, a lot of states require compactness. Almost all, I think, maybe all require contiguity. Contiguity means connectedness of a district. Respect for political subdivision lines, partisan fairness, competitiveness. Depending on the state, you'll have different types of requirements. So let's. So now we're going to talk about the constitutional constraints on redistricting plans. And obviously, there are a lot of one-person, one-vote cases, and we've talked already about them for two sessions or so. But let's just review for a second. So that the court originally, in Colgrove versus Green, wanted to avoid the political thicket of redistricting. The idea that courts would come in and affirmatively remap a state was seen by Justice Frankfurter as a completely unrealistic possibility. But 16 years later, in Baker versus Carr, the court holds that malapportionment cases raise justiciable questions under the 14th Amendment, right? It means they can be justiced. That they are, it doesn't come out in Baker versus Carr with a standard as to what makes a malapportioned plan unconstitutional, as we discussed. But it does say that you can go into court and litigate them under the Equal Protection Clause. 2 years later, though, it comes up with the one-person, one-vote rule in Reynolds versus Sims and all of the companion cases that we discussed. Lucas versus 44th General Assembly, Westbury versus Sanders, Gray versus Sanders. These are all cases that strike down one or another redistricting plan as unconstitutional because it's malapportioned. And so out of Reynolds versus Sims and the companion cases, we get the rule that you cannot have districts that are substantially overpopulated or underpopulated, that you have to make districts that are as equal as is practicable. But as we discussed, that just tells you about the numbers that have to be sort of evened out between districts. It doesn't tell you who should be in those districts or what the denominator should be. And so the court has left open, at least implicitly in Burns versus Richardson, or explicitly in Burns versus Richardson and implicitly since then, has said that, well, you could draw districts based on equal numbers of registered voters. Right? And as we discussed, the fact that you have flexibility in the denominator, right, whether you can draw districts based on total numbers of people, voting age population, citizen voting age population, registered voters, eligible voters, actual voters, that the differences between each of those statistics is huge. And so Burns versus Richardson is still on the books, but for the most part, every jurisdiction uses the total population numbers that come from the Census Bureau. There is a bit of a difference this time around in the 2012 redistricting. Some states like New York, Maryland, and Delaware have all passed laws that require reallocation of prisoners to their pre-incarceration address, which raises is inviting some litigation under the one-person, one-vote rule. But the rule out of the one-person, one-vote cases is different depending on which type of redistricting plan a court is considering. So in Karcher versus Daggett, the court found that the plan, despite the fact that the largest district was only 0.7% greater in its population than the smallest district, that districting plan was unconstitutional because the rule for congressional districts is something close to perfect population equality unless you can show that legitimate interests justify every deviation in the plan. I've highlighted for you, this is the map that was in the Supreme Court case itself, but just to give you a sense of what one of the districts looked like and how it was described, right? In a flight of cartographic fancy, one commentator notes that's in Justice Stevens' opinion, the legislature packed North Jersey Republicans into a new district that many call the Swan. So you can see the Swan here. Its long neck and twisted body stretch from the New York suburbs to the rural upper reaches of the Delaware River. That district contains segments from at least seven counties. The same commentator described the seventh district, which is down here, this sort of fishhook district, comprised of parts of five counties, is tracing a curving partisan path through industrial Elizabeth, liberal academic Princeton, and largely Jewish Marlborough and Monmouth County. The resulting monstrosity was called the fishhook by detractors. One thing you'll notice by the redistricting cases is that they really do bring out the sort of art appreciation side of Supreme Court justices, and so there's a lot of in-depth description. But the rule that comes out of Karcher versus Daggett is a rule of really severe population equality, derived not from the Equal Protection Clause, but from Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says that the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, right? And as a result, the conclusion from Karcher is that states have to make a good faith effort to achieve mathematical equality unless you can justify every deviation in the plan by some legitimate state interest. And that's going to be very difficult, which is why so many states actually draw districts that achieve perfect population equality. If you look at the maps that the students have been drawing at drawcongress.org for my other class, each one of them deviates by no more than one person between districts. Now, of course, the census data aren't accurate to that level, right? But that's if you want to be safe under the rule of Karcher, that's what you do. Now, it's not true for other types of legislative districts, like city council districts and state legislative districts, that the court has been more flexible, usually allowing for plus or minus 5% deviations, which is to say a total deviation of around 10% is presumptively valid. Okay? But even then, as we discussed in Larios versus Cox, you have to be careful because if there are impermissible reasons that you've deviated, then there's going to be a problem. And then finally, there are special purpose districts like water districts, like water reclamation districts in Ball versus James that we discussed, that where you don't have to abide by a rule of perfect population equality. It could be 1 acre, one vote. And so in Larios versus Cox, the court rejects the idea that there's a safe harbor for deviations of, say, 10% in state legislative districts, and that you cannot illegitimately justify these deviations. So let me just show you the state Senate plan that was at issue in Georgia. As I've said before, I'm not responsible for this map. I'm responsible for the court-drawn map that came after it. But so just to give a just look, this is the Democratic gerrymander of the Georgia State Senate districts. These are not rivers. This is a district, okay? Here's another in District 24. Okay, right? You can see all these, some going in here, just to blow up some of them. Right, so this is District 24, goes up and down. And you can see some more of the House districts as they go and are barely contiguous at some points, right? 87 goes up and around. And the reason that they were struck down as unconstitutional, even though they deviated by plus or minus 5%, is that the Democrats, in order to keep their hold on the Assembly and the Senate, overpopulated the Republican districts and underpopulated the Democratic districts, which you can see here. If you look at the blue areas were the Democratic areas, the red areas were the Republican areas in the state. And then you can see the deviations, right? The red areas were overpopulated and the blue areas were underpopulated. So you can see how they kind of match up with the partisanship in the state. And so the strategic use of deviations in a plan to overpopulate your opponent's districts and underpopulate yours, or to specifically advantage some parts of the states at the expense of others, would be a problem, even for non-congressional districts. Now, The problem, as I said in Lars versus Cox, is that this was a partisan gerrymander that selectively used malapportionment to punish political adversaries, right? But that doesn't mean partisan gerrymanders or partisanship in general is unconstitutional and is as a factor in the redistricting process. Instead, the Supreme Court has actually resigned itself to the fact that partisanship will often be an extremely important factor in the redistricting process. And in Gaffney versus Cummings, it upheld a bipartisan gerrymander. So the intent of the Connecticut redistricting plan in that case was to create districts that were safe for Democrats and Republicans. And so the idea was if it was a 50% Democratic state, 50% Republican state, that they drew districts that would be 50%, half the districts might be Democrat, half the districts would be Republican, and as a result, you would get a politically fair outcome, right? It would also mean, though, that you wouldn't have a whole lot of competition between the districts, right, or within the districts. The court looks at those lines and says a bipartisan gerrymander of that ilk is constitutional, despite the fact that it might lead to lower competition. Now, bipartisan gerrymanders are, of course, different than partisan gerrymanders. So you might think, well, that a bipartisan gerrymander is okay, but a partisan gerrymander, if it strategically packs your opponents into a few districts and spreads your supporters about among many, would be unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court in 1986 said, yeah, maybe, right? That in Davis versus Vandermeer, which dealt with a gerrymander of the Indiana districts, the court holds that partisan gerrymanders are justiciable, right? Just as it held one person, one vote cases were justiciable in Baker versus Carr. But it creates a very high standard for what might be an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. It says that discriminatory effect occurs if the electoral system is arranged in a manner that will consistently degrade a voter's or group of voters' influence on the political process as a whole. And such a finding unconstitutionality must be supported by evidence of continued frustration of the will of a majority of voters or effective denial of a minority of voters of a fair chance to influence the political process, right? And so in order to have a standard as to what is an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander, you need to know what it means to continually frustrate the will of majority or minority of voters, right? And it's because of that high standard that the Supreme Court has never found any partisan gerrymander to be unconstitutional. It had to revisit the holding in Davis versus Vandermeer and Veith versus Jubilier, and it didn't come up with anything more clear. In fact, if anything, it's even harder to follow at this point. These are the Pennsylvania congressional districts, well, that have existed until recently. And you can see some of the, this was a Republican gerrymander, so you can see some of the ways they dealt with Philadelphia here. Oh, here's Philadelphia here, and one of these districts goes up and down like this. And a lot of it was taking some of the Democrats in here and joining them with suburbs that were more Republican. As I said, this gerrymander failed in many ways because they cut the majorities too thinly. But in Veith versus Jubilier, the court revisits Vandermeer and splits 4-4-1. So you had the four conservatives on the court said that this is a non-justiciable political question. The court should get out of this, right? Echoing the concerns of Justice Frankfurter that there are no standards here because everyone agrees that partisanship will be part of the process, but we don't have any standards to say when how much partisanship is too much partisanship. The four more liberal justices had said, here we have standards, and they proposed three different standards that might be used by the court. And we'll talk more about Veith in the next class. And then Justice Kennedy, as is his tradition, was by himself and provided the critical fifth vote, both to uphold the gerrymander in this instance, but also to say that I'm going to keep these justiciable questions, even though I don't have a standard. And so that where we are in partisan gerrymandering is that you can still litigate these cases, but Justice Kennedy says in Veith versus Jubilier that we think you should maybe go look in the First Amendment to see whether you can find a standard that might helpful in determining when partisanship is too much partisanship. And the reason you would look into the First Amendment is because that's the area where the discrimination on the basis of partisan affiliation might give rise to constitutional problems, right? Because if, for example, and the court has a whole line of cases dealing with patronage where you can't fire school teachers because they're Democrats, right, or Republicans. And so if you can't do that under the First Amendment, maybe there's a First Amendment injury if you discriminate against Democrats in the drawing of redistricting plans. But right now, that's just speculative, that there's just the possibility that that there will be a standard. But Veith versus Jubilee keeps partisan gerrymandering claims alive, but without any guidance as to when they might be unconstitutional. And if you thought that there was a likely outcome from that case, with Justice Kennedy maybe coming up in the next situation to strike down a gerrymander as unconstitutional, the mid-decade gerrymander of Texas's congressional districts, which we'll spend a lot of time talking about in this class, suggested that it's going to be a very, very high bar to cross if you're going to show that something is an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. So you can see the districts that these were the districts that were drawn by a court, which actually led to a significant number of Democrats being elected and reelected, I should say, for Texas for Congress in 2002. Once the Republicans gained control of the state legislature in Texas, they then redrew the lines. And so you can see many of these districts going all the way from Mexico to the Austin metro area. And as a result of these, this districting plan, you can also see some of the other funny shapes up here, going up here. This is Houston and I think Dallas. That as a result of this redistricting plan, something like four or five Democrats lost their seats and were replaced by Republicans. As it turned out, we'll talk about this when we deal with the Voting Rights Act, the Supreme Court struck down this district as violating Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act because it diluted the Hispanic vote. But when it came to the aggressive use of partisanship in the drawing of lines, the court didn't find it to be unconstitutional, even if it was done in the middle of a decade. And one sort of story or lesson to be learned from both Lulac versus Perry and Larios versus Cox is that the while there aren't partisan gerrymandering claims that have found favor at the court, partisan claims are often litigated through other kinds of claims, like one person, one vote cases in the case of Larios versus Cox, or Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act claims, which were done in Lulac versus Perry. Now, as I suggested at the beginning, when we looked at those Mississippi congressional districts, you can dilute the minority vote through many different stratagems, right? You can do it through over-concentration as well as under-concentration. The 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment potentially place constraints on redistricting. You saw the 15th Amendment situation with Gamillion versus Lightfoot. But that's a special set of facts. Up until the 1980s, and then with the case of Mobile versus Bolden, the court explained that the constitutional constraints on redistricting plans when it comes to equal protection are similar or can be similar to other types of unconstitutional state action. So redistricting, which is intended to disadvantage a minority community, right? Or for that matter, just to discriminate against a racial group, any racial group, right? If you have discriminatory purpose and discriminatory effect, that would violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, if you sort of had random districts, or if you draw districts on the basis of political subdivision lines, and it has the effect of diluting the minority vote, that doesn't necessarily violate the Constitution. But if, as was shown in Mississippi, you set out to crack and pack the minority community so as to diminish their political influence, then that's the same problem as you would get in any other kind of situation under, for example, Arlington Heights, right? or Washington versus Davis, those cases you remember from your constitutional law class, where if you are discriminating on the basis of race, intentionally trying to dilute the minority vote, it's going to be unconstitutional. And the standard there is that race must have been the reason that you have drawn the districts in this particular way. As they say in Personnel versus Administrator versus Feeney, it was because of, not merely in spite of, the race of the voters that you drew this district, right? But there's another kind of racial gerrymandering cause of action, and these are the ones that caused the most controversy in the 1990s. And this is known as the Shaw versus Reno line of cases, or the excessive use of race in redistricting. And so you need a little bit of history here in order to understand how we got here about 20 years ago. That because of the 1982 amendments to the Voting Rights Act, court interpretations, as well as the aggressive use of the Voting Rights Act to create majority-minority districts in the 1990s, there were many districts, as you'll see, that were somewhat strangely shaped, that were majority-minority districts. Those majority-minority districts gave rise to a lot of litigation, and in the case of Shaw versus Reno, the court creates an analytically distinct cause of action. It's different than racial vote dilution. And the claim comes from the fact that there is an expressive harm created by use of the predominant use of race in the construction of a district. It's not that whites are underrepresented because you've drawn these majority-minority districts. It's that the use of race as the predominant factor in the district sort of commits racial stereotyping, right? It is a expressive harm that sends a message that the voters think alike and prefer the same candidates at the polls. You can see a little of this from, this was the district in Shaw versus Reno, and I'll just read a little bit from the court's opinion, right? District that goes all the way down I-85 in North Carolina. And so this was District 12. And as O'Connor describes it, it's even more unusually shaped. It's approximately 160 miles long, and for much of its length, no wider than the I-85 corridor. It winds in snake-like fashion through tobacco country, financial centers, and manufacturing areas until it gobbles in enough enclaves of black neighborhoods. Northbound and southbound drivers on I-85 sometimes find themselves in separate districts in one county, only to trade districts when they enter the next county. Of the 10 counties through which District 12 passes, five are cut into three different districts. Even towns are divided. At one point, the district remains contiguous only because it intersects at a single point with two other districts before crossing over them. One state legislator has remarked that if you drove down the interstate with both your car doors open, you'd kill most of the people in the district. Right? The hard part in trying to figure out what a Shaw versus Reno claim is about is trying to figure out who is injured by this, right? Because, you know, generally speaking, we don't care, as you saw in the Georgia situation, we don't care that something is funny shaped, right? Compactness is not a constitutional requirement, generally speaking. And so the hardest part, maybe the most controversial part, the Shaw versus Reno line of cases, is trying to figure out this nature of an expressive harm, right? Who is injured? Is it whites who are injured, right? Well, they still had majority. There were white majorities in 10 out of the 12 districts in North Carolina, so they were overrepresented. Is it African Americans who are injured? Well, how are they injured by the creation of these majority-minority districts, right? Is it everyone who's injured? Because it sends a signal about the relevance of race to politics. So you get that sense from the opinion itself, where O'Connor, for the court, writes, "We believe that reapportionment is one area in which appearances do matter." Now, mind you, that doesn't mean that all bizarre districts are going to be unconstitutional. It just means that there's something about the creation of a bizarre majority-minority district that is a problem. So a reapportionment plan that includes in one district individuals who belong to the same race but who are otherwise widely separated by geographical and political boundaries and who may have little in common with one another but the color of their skin bears an uncomfortable resemblance to political apartheid. It reinforces the perception that members of the same racial group, regardless of their age, education, economic status, or the community in which they live, think alike, share the same political interests, and will prefer the same candidates at the polls. Right? So that's a very different kind of injury than you're familiar with in equal protection law, right? In Mobile versus Bolden and those types of cases, Gamillion versus Lightfoot, or the situation I showed you in Mississippi in 1966, the argument there is that you have diminished the political power of a racial group by the way you have drawn the lines. Here, it's not that. It's not that you've diminished the political power. It's that you've sent a certain message. And that message, as she says, is that it reinforces the perception that members of the same racial group, right, think alike, share the same political interests, and will prefer the same candidates at the polls. And so that kind of racial stereotyping creates an injury under the 14th Amendment. And they cite Gamillion versus Lightfoot as an example of that, right? Now, Gamillion versus Lightfoot, though, remember the story there is that they excise pretty much all the African Americans from Tuskegee. Here, it's not that they have excised all the whites from the I-85 district. In fact, this district, if this is about segregation, right, let alone political apartheid, these districts are about roughly just over 50% of the voters in the district were African American. They were drawn in order to satisfy the Voting Rights Act, or DOJ's interpretation of it, which turned out to be too aggressive, all right? And there were a whole host of districts that then were challenged under Shaw. And you can see the funny shapes, right? This is, now you can see the why the court really gets into its art appreciation mode, right? This is, the Georgia district is not so strange, but the court, because of the history of the drawing of that district, where the NAACP proposed the plan and the way they described the district as the Max Black plan, right? If you learn anything about from Shaw versus Reno line of cases, don't call your district plan the Max Black plan. That would be an unconstitutional red flag. The Florida case, actually in Loria versus Department of Justice, they upheld one of the districts. Louisiana, Hayes versus Louisiana, these were challenged. These are the districts in Texas at the time. Actually, three of these are minority districts, and one is a majority white district. Three of them are unconstitutional. One of them is not. And so one of the questions is, well, what work is compactness doing in bizarre shapes, right? Because the court is not going to come out and say, all right, square districts are required under the Constitution. In fact, sometimes you look in New York, look at the districts that we have here, a lot of them follow the subway lines, right? The district just below the one we're in goes all the way from West 85th Street down the west side of Manhattan, over the Brooklyn Bridge, into Borough Park, all the way to Coney Island. It's affectionately described as the Nathans to Zabar's district. It follows a very long, largely white, but not exclusively, community that goes all the way from the upper west side of Manhattan all the way into Queens, and Brooklyn, I mean. The case of Bush versus Vera is a very interesting one. So there were two African-American districts that were struck down in Bush versus Vera and a Hispanic district, the Hispanic district's there. This is actually the Anglo district. And race was seen as the predominant factor in the construction of those districts, but not in the white district. And Justice Stevens described, this is District 6, which was the white district. District 6, he says, has far less of an identifiable core than any of the majority-minority districts struck down by the district court, right? To the extent that it begins anywhere, it probably near the home of incumbent Representative Barton and Innes, located almost 40 miles southwest of downtown Dallas. From there, the district winds across predominantly rural sections of Ellis County, finally crossing into Tarrant County, the home of Fort Worth. It skips across two arms of Joe Pool Lake, noses its way into Dallas County, and then travels through predominantly Republican suburbs of Fort Worth. Nearing the central city, the borders dart into the downtown area, then retreat to curl around the city's northern edge, picking up airport and growing suburbs north of town. Worn from its travels into the far northwestern corner of the county, almost 70 miles as the crow flies from Ennis, the district lines plunge south into Eagle Mountain Lake, traveling along the waterline for miles, with occasional detours to collect voters that have built homes along its shores. Refreshed, the district rediscovers its roots in rural Parker County, then flows back toward Fort Worth to the southwest for another bite at Republican voters near the heart of the city. As it does so, the district narrows in places to not much more than a football field in width. Finally, it heads back into the rural regions of its fifth county, Johnson, where it finally exhausts itself, only 50 miles from its origin, but hundreds of miles apart in distance and worlds apart in culture. I love the refreshed line in there, right? Refreshed from its chapter. And so the question is, well, why are the minority districts unconstitutional in this case, but the white district is not? So it's not just that something looks funny, because there are a lot of really funny looking districts out there. And so you really have to work with the Shaw line of cases to figure out exactly what it is, which is making them unconstitutional. And so the elements of a Shaw versus Reno cause of action are that race has predominated in the construction of a district. Okay. In that traditional districting principles have been subordinated. All right, now, what are traditional districting principles? The truth is it depends on what state you're talking about or looking at the history of a state. But the court will frequently, if not in all of these cases, say, if race predominates over compactness, contiguity, respect for political subdivision lines, those are sort of the big three, then it's likely that race might have been used impermissibly in the process to raise a 14th Amendment claim. There may be other reasons that you can see race predominating in the process, as you could see from the descriptions with Justice O'Connor in Shaw versus Reno, right? If communities of interest were broken up along the way, if you've sort of paired incumbents in a way that violates traditions, and if you have drawn districts, another traditional districting principle might be ensuring a reliable district for a political party. In the Shaw versus Reno line of cases, in Easley versus Cromartie, the Shaw versus Reno line of cases are sort of interesting. Because of these districting plans that North Carolina had drawn in the 1990s, their congressional districts were not approved until 2001. And so just before the new redistricting plan was going to be drawn. And the court approved them there because the redrawn plan, they said, look, this is not an African-American district. This is a safe Democratic district. Okay, and they showed that this was the most reliable group of Democratic voters and that they basically were discriminating against Republicans, not discriminating against others. And so that if you can show that, that the reason for the district is that you are protecting a political party, well, then that would be constitutionally not a problem. And that would get you out from saying that race is the predominant factor or from that claim by saying that party predominated in the redistricting process. As I said, even if you have a square district that you've drawn, if there are other indicia of racially discriminatory intent, such as if you call the plan the Max Black Plan, right, or if there are reasons to think that what you've done is specifically to draw districts that are majority-minority districts, then you might have a problem. Now, once you show that race has predominated in the construction of a district, that's not the end of the inquiry. There's still the possibility that you could say that this passes strict scrutiny. Now, you remember from your constitutional law classes that it's very hard to pass strict scrutiny, so that a racial classification is ordinarily subject to strict scrutiny, whether you're talking about one that favors or disfavors the minority. Meaning that it has to serve a compelling state interest and it must be narrowly tailored in order to serve that interest. But as you know, if you apply strict scrutiny to something, it's usually strict in theory but fatal in fact, right? Almost nothing passes strict scrutiny, right? One example in sort of recent years, leaving outside the redistricting context, is University of Michigan Affirmative Action Program, which you may have heard the Supreme Court now just took another affirmative action case out of Texas. But the idea there was that diversity provided a compelling state interest that that justified the use of race in the admissions process. Here, there's only one potential compelling interest that the court has identified. And even then, it hasn't really found a situation like this, but it says that only if the district is narrowly tailored to avoid a violation of the Voting Rights Act might it pass strict scrutiny. And so that's a hard one because, as we described, in those districts were all drawn originally in order to comply with the Voting Rights Act, or at least DOJ's interpretation of it. But the court found that the states went too far, that you didn't have to draw districts like that. And I want to say as a caveat that that is, out of Bush versus Vera, the rule that comes out is that you could draw districts that are narrowly tailored to avoid a voting rights violation, and maybe that's going to pass strict scrutiny. But as you know from the news, and as we'll talk about in class, the Voting Rights Act is under assault, and that it is likely the Supreme Court may strike down parts, at least of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act at some point in the next year. And so if parts of the Voting Rights Act, such as Section 5, are unconstitutional, then it might be the case that, at least with Section 5, you cannot say that a district that is drawn predominantly based on race passes strict scrutiny in order to comply with the Voting Rights Act. But there is an interesting case which did come out of lower court, which was summarily affirmed by the district court, and that is the famous case of the Chicago Earmuff District. Okay, and so in King versus Illinois, the court actually said, you know what, this is a Shaw violation. This district in Chicago, the 4th Congressional District of Chicago, which has lasted until basically this day. And this district was drawn in order to deal with the Hispanic, the different locations of the Latino and the black populations in Chicago. And so, as you can see, the green areas are the Latino areas, the red areas are African American. And so, in order to create a Latino district, they drew it going like this, down here, all the way down and around, okay? And the Latino district, they said, was justified because if you were to draw a district that went in a circle like this, then that would violate the Voting Rights Act because African Americans wouldn't be able to elect their candidate of choice, maybe. And that it was because each of these groups may have had a claim under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that the drawing of a district like this was required and was narrowly tailored to avoid a voting rights violation. All right, so there's still the possibility that you can draw districts like this. All right, so here's where we are. When it comes to one person, one vote, we have different rules depending on what types of districts we're talking about. If we're talking about congressional district, there's a very strict rule of population equality. The court doesn't say that it must be mathematically equal, but you must make a good faith attempt to achieve equality, and any deviations have to be justified by a consistently applied legitimate state interest. Now, there's a more lenient standard for non-congressional districts, especially if the total deviation in the plan is under 10%, but the Lawyers versus Cox case tells you that if you have selectively malapportioned in order to punish your political opponents and reward your friends, that that is going to be a problem. When it comes to partisan gerrymandering, the court, we're sort of waiting to get an answer from the court. Bipartisan gerrymanders are seen as politically safe, even if they result in lower competition. So you have pure Democratic districts, pure Republican districts, that's not a problem. When one party is trying to shaft the out party, though, that does give rise to a potentially justiciable partisan gerrymandering claim, at least as long as Justice Kennedy is still contemplating what the standard might be. Right? Maybe this redistricting cycle, he'll find one that runs afoul of it. But as I said, just because there is no concrete partisan gerrymandering claim that the Supreme Court has delivered us doesn't mean that disgruntled partisans don't go into court. They filter their partisan claims through other types of claims, such as one person, one vote claims, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act claims, and Shaw versus Reno claims, right? Because sort of the moral of the story in redistricting law is that you sort of throw everything at the court and see what sticks. And so in the racial gerrymandering context, there is a postmortem on the Shaw cases, which is that while there was a lot of redistricting litigation in the 1990s under Shaw. In the 2000 round of redistricting, we saw almost none of it. And that has to do with the fact that that last case that I talked about, Easley versus Cromartie, where they said, look, you can justify the districts as creating safe Democratic districts. Now no one is going to be passing something called the Max Black Plan, right? It's the Max Dem Plan or something like that, Max Rep Plan. So that if you can justify it on the basis of partisanship, well then, that's one way to get out from under the constraints of Shaw versus Reno. Moreover, if it turns out the minority districts and the white districts are all equally strangely shaped, then it's hard to say that race predominated in the construction of the minority districts. But it is still the case, and we have actually cases from the case in Texas right now where an intentional race-based vote dilution claim is being brought. And that still, under Mobile versus Bolden, can violate equal protection if you go out and intentionally are trying to dilute the vote of a minority community. And Shaw versus Reno is still on the books. So in the event the minority districts are extremely strangely shaped, and you have violated traditional districting principles in the drawing of these districts, and you can't justify them by appealing to the Voting Rights Act, then it's possible that those districts, those individual districts, will violate the 14th Amendment. So as you can see, we've come a long way since Elbridge Gerry first drew his plan, right? But the strategies that incumbents have been pursuing over these 200 years, and I should say it's an appropriate time for you to be taking this course because it is the 200th anniversary of the successful Elbridge Gerry gerrymander. So this fall, when you vote in those congressional elections, just think of Elbridge Gerry. For next time, we will talk more about partisan gerrymandering, and then we'll move on to the Voting Rights Act. Thank you.
Next week on Lectures in History, David Keene, president of the National Rifle Association, talks about the modern conservative political philosophy of William F. Buckley, Jr. Mr. Buckley, who died in 2008, was the founder of National Review magazine. David Keene was a guest lecturer at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina, in a course called The Conservative Intellectual Tradition in America, taught by Professor Mallory Factor. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.